rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Ross, Judge Rodenberg, Judge Jessen, the Honorable Kevin G. Ross presiding.
Good afternoon. I'd say please be seated, but we wouldn't be able to see you. The next matter on for oral argument this morning is Kilpatrick versus Meeker County. Counsel, each of you will have 5 minutes to present your argument, with an additional 5 minutes to appellant's counsel to use if you'd like for rebuttal. The timing restrictions, I believe, are indicated in a clock on your screen, if I'm not mistaken. So please be mindful of those limitations. Please state your name as you commence each leg of your argument, because we keep an audio recording, not a video recording, but an audio recording only of the proceedings. And this helps us to keep track of who's making which argument. Counsel for appellant, whenever you're ready to proceed, you may.
May it please the court. My name is Joel Novak, and I represent the appellants, the Kilpatricks, in this case. Our first argument is on substantial compliance. What we are actually arguing is actual compliance, which is more than substantial compliance, but certainly includes substantial compliance. Service was delivered to the chair of the board.
I guess I'm lost. So I'm clear, are you arguing that this was the functional equivalent or was actually compliant? I think those are two different things, and your brief seems to suggest the one, not the other.
I'll just say substantial compliance because that's what we argued in the brief. But if you have actual compliance, you have at least substantial compliance.
And, all right.
401A and 401E are different. 401A deals with an individual and says by delivering a copy to the individual personally. 401E deals with a public corporation and says by delivering a copy, no personal included. We have to assume that the writers of the rule knew what they were talking about, said what they meant. Delivery is an act by which the thing is placed in actual or constructive possession or control of another. It is not necessary that the delivery should be made by manual transfer. Here, there was service of delivery to the chair of the board. It stated the name of the court. It stated the names of the parties. It was signed by Kilpatrick's attorney. It was a notice of appeal, but Edrizek, Skyline, and Elbert all say that a notice of appeal is a summons in this kind of case.
I just want to make sure I understand, counsel, your argument. So you're saying because under Rule 4.03E, Subdivision 1, because it doesn't use the word personally in that, whereas in under A, it says to the individual personally, you're saying it does not have to be personal service, even though Rule 4.03 is entitled personal service.
Absolutely, Your Honor, because the title of the law is not part of the law. It's not binding like the words of a rule. Also, if you've ever drafted anything like this, you know you draft the substance first, and then you look at it, you start at the top. It would be very easy to name this personal service because you start by reading 4A that says personal service. But 4E doesn't require personal service. Plain and simple, it says delivering a copy.
Now that rule of construction that you described, I know, is something that we always say when it comes to statutes, because the legislature enacting laws does not enact the title. That's something that's added by someone else. It's not voted on, and so it has no legal meaning. Is that so as to rules? My understanding is that rules committees who pass these rules don't just include the text, but also the titles.
Title would overrule the actual words of the rule. The words seem much more important than the title.
But it wouldn't be overruling because the words don't say, you know, personal service is not required. It just doesn't say personal in that caption. Do you have any, you know, articles or cases or any sort of, you know, guidance that back up your interpretation of the rule?
I do not, but it would be extraordinarily misleading to practitioners, because if I'm looking to serve a governmental entity and I read by delivering a copy, that's what I'm going to do. It would be a trap for the unwary that didn't go back and say, now I've got to read the title of this and decide if the title or the portion I'm reading applies.
So, but now, if we can go, even if we assume that your reading is correct, the chair of the board here says he does not recall receiving this. I mean, so the county attorney recalled receiving the email. I just want to, like, follow this through, correct, on the service. And, you know, but the law clearly says it's the chair of the board or the county auditor, I believe, correct?
Okay. Your Honor, I agree totally with what you're asking. There's one problem, and that is we're not arguing that the service to the county attorney was proper at all. We're letting that one go. But to the chair of the board, he said that he did not receive the mail. He never said he did not receive the email. And beyond a shadow of a doubt, he did, because the county answered it. Turning to the second issue, the timeline here is extremely important. We know that the decision of the county was received by at least 18 September, because Meeker County filed his answer by the 18th of September. Using that as day one, Kirkpatrick's sought to add the collateral parties on 27 September 18, 9 days into this process. The court then set an amendment date of 8 November. Now, when you look at the 30 days from 394.27, it says 30 days for commencement of action. Then if you look at Dewar, it makes perfectly clear that commencing the action is one thing and adding parties is another thing. To quote the court, it said, at any stage of the action, they're completely two different things. When the court set that date for the 8th of November, Kirkpatrick's moved to add the parties on the 7th of November, the date before that. Nothing, no law whatsoever says that they have to be notified within the 30 days, and the court set a date that the Kirkpatrick's complied with. Also, if you look at Rule 19, it says that someone is necessary if those already parties cannot be afforded complete relief. This argument was completely between the Kirkpatrick's and the county. Anything else was collateral. The second is if a party claims an interest. Now, there was no evidence presented to show that Meeker would be prejudiced in any way, so the first clause does not apply. Also, the freeholders and the club, neither of them petitioned to be joined. And if you look at Rule 19, the question comes up, who, if anyone, has a duty? The only duty created by that rule is to the court itself. It says, the court shall order. Now, if there is a secondary duty, not a legal duty, but a fiduciary duty, it was to Meeker County, because they were kind of in the same boat as these collateral parties. The Kirkpatrick's had no duty whatsoever to try and join these parties, because their beef was merely with the county. The freeholder had a complete right to rent his land. The Kirkpatrick's do not dispute that. The club had a complete right to put in their application. The Kirkpatrick's don't dispute that. If they were to be joined at all, it should have been by the court or by Meeker County. Yet twice, Kirkpatrick's, in an abundance court. The Kirkpatricks are not doing anything wrong here. It's the other parties. Because they weren't joined, because the court failed, because Meeker County didn't engage in their fiduciary duty, now the district court says that the rifle rounds can start falling through our Kirkpatrick's yard and house.
So I can pause you for just one quick second. I think your opposing counsel is at a podium and is near a microphone, and so if you could stop shuffling papers near the microphone, it would help. Sorry, you may proceed.
Yes, Your Honor. The notes to Rule 19 are also interesting. The advisory committee said it was not the intent that failure to join causes lack of jurisdiction. Second, they say, the issue is can complete relief be granted? Between the two parties, complete relief can be granted. The third was, will a potential defendant be subjected to double or inconsistent judgments? Absolutely, 100% not.
So, if I could just turn you back for a moment, I'm still kind of pondering over your first argument, counsel. And I'm just trying to look at the rule on personal service, Rule 4.03, in the broader context. So two questions I have for you. I mean, because where we talk about where the rule as a Rule 4 as a whole seems to be talking about personal service and service by publication, it doesn't seem to be to give a lot of other options, you know, personal service by email. So, I mean, if we read it, shouldn't we be looking at it in that context? And also, you know, I didn't do the extensive research, but even just looking at the rules of practice series by her and Haydock, when they address service on public corporations, they do say the rule contemplates personal service upon the designated official of any entity. Now, I understand that's not precedent to us, but you haven't cited us any other support. Could you just address those two issues?
Yes, Your Honor. The only support I can say is by delivering a copy has a clear meaning. And if you look to Blacks, that clear meaning is to place it actually or constructive in the other party's hand, and that it does not have to be by manual transfer. When you read a rule, you should be able to abide by the words of the rule.
So if you were, say, bringing a lawsuit against Medtronic, your view would be that your client could, or you on your client's behalf, could email an officer of the company, and that would be sufficient to provide for service.
I'm not sure, Your Honor, because there is a separate subsection.
Yeah, subsection C. It's C. You pointed out E, but like E, the term personal is not included before the word delivery, either in under B for partnerships and associations, or C for corporations, or D upon the state. It's required that you deliver a copy to the Attorney General, the Deputy Attorney General, or an Assistant Attorney General. So your view would be if you sent an email to the Assistant Attorney General, that would be sufficient for service of a complaint to commence a lawsuit. Just so I'm understanding your argument.
Yes, Your Honor.
And is there were you able to find any cases that support this theory?
No, but it has actually never been argued before. It's an issue of first impression. To say that the word's there when it's not, I don't see how you can do that. That creates a law that nobody knew was there.
Why just email? What if, could you telephone someone and orally communicate the content of a complaint? Would that be delivering the information sufficient for the commencement?
If nothing else prohibits it, yes, Your Honor. Now, there would be a problem then that you would prove, but
What about posting it on a billboard out in front of the office? Would that be sufficient? I mean, that's delivering information.
That would be extremely risky because there...
That's the extent of your concession?
That is the extent. If you do it in a way reasonably expected to reach the other party and it actually reaches them...
Facebook. What about a Facebook communication? I don't know how Facebook works. I'm not on Facebook, but I think I hear there's something you can do to signal the recipient that you have a message for that person, and that's the way communication is delivered and information is delivered these days. I gather under your theory that would be sufficient also.
I see my time has expired. May I answer?
Please.
Yes, Your Honor. It would depend. They would have to receive it. If you have a Facebook account, you might check it every 5 minutes. You might check it every 5 years.
Why would they have to receive it? It's the rule requires delivery, right? So you're saying that delivery is sufficient. So if I post it on Facebook, I've delivered it.
I'm saying it has to be given so that there is either actual or constructive possession.
Okay. Your time has expired, but I think one or more of the judges do have follow-up questions for you, Judge Jessen, I believe.
So, counsel, that just means, to me, this is kind of circular because you're saying there has to be actual delivery, and then that isn't your argument really that actual notice is enough, and that's what the, like, Yeager versus Palladium Holdings and others said, no, actual notice isn't enough.
Well, but were they 408 or 401A cases or 401E? Most of those cases that I read were 401A. That's completely different. Personal service is required.
No, this was actually not, but I understand your point, so.
Did you have a question?
I'm good.
Thank you. You will have 5 additional minutes of rebuttal if you'd like to return at that time.
Yes, Your Honor.
Counsel for respondent. If you're speaking, counsel for respondent, we're not hearing you. Is the microphone on?
It is not, Your Honor.
All right, there's the difference.
The
yes, thank you. Go ahead.
Scott Anderson, and I represent Meeker County Board of Commissioners. Judge, there is a case that deals with electronic transmission of service. It was decided, it's the Kofish case. It's cited on page 18 of our brief. That case says electronic transmission of summons and complaint, or call it a notice of appeal, I don't care, is not sufficient under Rule 403. In fact, all the cases under Rule 403...
Was that a 403A case or a 403E case?
I don't know, Your Honor, and I don't believe that it matters whether it's 403A or 403E.
Can you address the literal reference to personally, the term personally in A and its omission from B, C, D, and E?
Well, I think yes, I can. And the reason I believe that there's a slight difference in reading under 403A and the rest of it is that under 403A, it's you are allowed to leave a copy of a summons and complaint at a person's usual place of abode, whereas under any of these others, you aren't allowed to do that. So the distinction is meant to show you're either going to give it to him personally or you can leave it as his usual place of abode. And of course, we know if you talk about the substantial compliance and those kinds of doctrines, as the Turek case I cited says, it only applies to substituted service at the place of abode and to nothing else. Judge, we've got three arguments here, Your Honors. We have three arguments and three decisions that were made by the district court there. And there's three different grounds, standards of review that apply. There was a decision that this case was not properly served. And while normally I would say service of process is a question of law, which of course you review de novo,
The case law always also says, and it's Lewis v. Contracting Northwest, that the district court decides disputed facts on that, and then I guess I'd probably say it's mixed question of fact and law, which means then that it's abuse of discretion or clearly erroneous. The failure to serve the summons that we argued about, in other words, you have to have a summons, that's clearly merely a legal argument you review de novo. And then the failure to join an indefensible party, that the Schultz versus Town of Duluth case cited in my brief says that the standard of review is abuse of discretion. The fact here is there has been no legitimate service of process, I don't care what you call it, under the rules. And we know that without that, there's no jurisdiction. Here you had to serve process within 30 days of receipt of the notice of the decision. And that's under 6A.02G7 of the zoning ordinance. The board chair was never served here. The auditor was never served. The plaintiffs have conceded that they're not arguing that the county attorney was served. So there's no service. None whatsoever. The plaintiff argues that service by mail is sufficient, and yet there's not one case at all that supports that in Minnesota law. And in fact, even if you look at the rules dictate a result that's otherwise met. Delivery in the Simmelman and Cox cases, both cited in my brief, and one for sure, Cox dealt with delivery to the sheriff. They indicated that electronic transmission did not constitute delivery in Cox, a Supreme Court case just decided this last year, and that you had to personally deliver it to them. Now, for a sheriff delivery, you can't mail, but that's a different set of circumstances. He still has to serve personally in order for it to be effective. And if you look at Rule 405 are the only circumstances where you do not have to personally serve by delivering a copy to the person designated by statute. Rule 405, we used to call it acknowledgement of service by mail. Now it's called a waiver of service. You have to send that form, and in order, the cases all say the same. If you're going to serve by mail for it to be effective, there must be a return of a waiver of service. None of that happened in this case. There's an argument that there's been no proof of actual receipt of the notice. I'd say a few things on that. I know it wasn't raised by Mr. Novak in his presentation here, but it's in the brief. Number one, that's a new argument that was never raised below, which certainly we couldn't address that. But number two, there's clearly all necessary in the record to show that delivery is presumed, and it would be a burden of them to show it never occurred. There's an affidavit of Ms. Cote, document 18, paragraph 5, and exhibit 1 there too, is the notice of decision that was served on September 14. She indicates that she personally oversaw its mailing. The address on it is the same address in the notice of appeal given for the plaintiffs. With all of that, that's regularly mailed. There's a presumption of delivery. And in fact, 6AG.07A says that, it says that delivery is complete upon mailing. So if we're giving them a right to go to district court under rule 602AG7, then they have to comply with all of that. So we had delivery here on September 14th. I would point to section 501A10A of the zoning ordinance. One of the zoning administrator's duties is to send notices of decisions to people. Therefore, this is something that occurred in the regular course of business and under law, all law, even the law acknowledged by Mr. Mack in delivery is presumed. The court found that there was a failure to join indispensable parties in this case. You know, she went through the factors.
So I just want to make sure I understand before you get into that your position on this. So I assume that your position is, okay, we established the delivery of the order upon mailing on September 14th, and there was, of the county's decision, the CUP decision, and that because there was no personal service of the appeal within the 30 days, then we don't have to go further than that.
I would say yes.
I just want to make sure I understood. Okay.
As a separate and distinct ground for dismissing the case, the court ruled on our motion on Rule 19, failure to join an indispensable party. Let me just say a couple of things about that because Mr. Novak misstated some facts from the record here, and I want to correct the record. Mr. Novak said that on September 27th, they sought to add parties. I'm not aware of that ever occurring. On September 27th, there was a pretrial conference that I took part in with Mr. Frank, and not with the judge, with the judge's clerk. And as a result of that, there was a scheduling order issued on October 3, which is document number 9. The scheduling order did not set November 8 as a hearing on a motion to amend. The court said the scheduling order, document 9, set November 8th as the deadline to bring those motions. And the plaintiffs waited until November 7th to bring their motion, even though we have raised these issues in our answer. I didn't dispute that perhaps it was brought up at the scheduling conference by Mr. Frank. And the reason I didn't is because I can't recall. And I know when we were discussing whether to address a mediation date, I told the court I didn't, or the clerk, we shouldn't have one because, after all, this is an issued CUP. The county can't do anything to destroy its interests, so we can't do it. I would also say this whole argument that the duty is on the court or the county to join the landowners in this case has no support in the law whatsoever. In fact, if you read the rule, it's quite clear the way Rule 19 reads, and the fact that a case can be dismissed if you don't join the parties that are deemed necessary and indispensable, that the onus is on the plaintiff or the party who brings the lawsuit to get it right. And I don't think there can be any argument that the landowner Schmidt and the Eamon Valley Sports Hits Club are both necessary and indispensable. I mean, if you look at factors A and B under 1902, the extent of judgment rendered in the person's absence might be prejudicial to the person. The extent to which, by protective provisions in the judgment or by shaking relief, the prejudice can be lessened. They're seeking to destroy a property right granted to the Schmidts, Schmidt and Eamon Valley here. Clearly, it's necessary. Clearly, they're indisputable. And the Schultz case, decided by this court not 5 months ago, 8 months ago, is directly on point. The final argument we made, and the one I do want to hit, unless you're going to question me, is the failure to serve a summons because I find it a fascinating argument. And let's just be clear about this. And I want to cite a case that I cited in my reply brief below, but I forgot to cite in my brief. It's de Blasio versus St. Paul. It's unpublished, so it's not precedential, but it cites published cases. 206 Westlaw, 1704172. Here's the thing. The only basis under the law ever where a court said you could initiate a civil action in the district court without a summons was Curtis versus Otter Tail County in 1996. This court just agreed in the Schultz case again, and that was overruled by the Satellite said the question wasn't that. The question was whether commencing a civil action by invoking the jurisdiction of the court under 301, or whether it was invoking the jurisdiction and thus isn't the commencement of an action, and Satellite clearly held it was. And how that applies to a failure to serve a summons. You've got to comply with the rules. Rules 1, 2, 3, they all require a summons. So does Rule 4.
But I think that why the appellant is arguing, I know he didn't reach this in the oral argument, but looking at his brief, is that when you look at the skyline, it says a summons is simply any document that commences a civil action, that can be read broadly to something that starts a civil action as opposed to kind of the form language that, you know, most lawyers would look at and say, yep, that's a summons.
Absolutely, that phrase is in Skyline. Skyline also says that a summons is a writ commanding you to appear and telling you when to answer. Point being, it was not an issue as to whether the notice of appeal in that case constituted a summons. Let's just put it this way. We have a 7-page document that's a legal argument with facts that is a complaint. It's not a summons. Remember, you're supposed to serve a summons and complaint. And the plaintiffs, in this case, their attorney considered it a complaint because they made a motion to amend it under Rule 15. Document 11 says, we want to amend the notice set forth in the proper procedural form consistent with that required by the rules. And then in their memo, Document 12, they argued under Rule 15 they wanted to amend their pleadings. If it walks like a duck, squawks like a duck, it's a duck. But if it doesn't, it's not. This is not a summons. It's nothing like a summons. And you need one under the law. Thank you.
Thank you. Any rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. I'd like to start with Bukowicz. That case, at least in dicta, does somewhat go against the Kirkpatricks. However, it was not raised, it was not argued, and it was not considered there. So really, it's nothing in the case before the court here. The Dewar case is the only one that clearly addresses the issue of joinder. And it says that you must commence the action within 30 days. When the notice of appeal was filed, served, received, that commenced the case. The Dewar court said that additional parties could be added at any stage of the action. There are two different things.
Right, but just counsel, just based on what you just said, you certainly would agree that your indispensable party's argument depends upon valid service to begin with, and so that's the initial hurdle you need to get over, correct?
Yes, Your Honor. Also, in dealing with that, looking at O'Sell, the court said, substantial compliance combined with actual notice will subject the individual to personal jurisdiction. Service of process is intended to give notice, reasonably calculated to reach the opposition and afford them an opportunity to present their objections. All that was complied with here. It went on to say evidence that service actually reached the intended person strongly supports a conclusion that service is valid. It continues, and O'Sell was a 401A case. This is a 401E case.
So under 401, so under a 401-3E case, or a 403E case, a text message or a tweet would be sufficient, as long as there's an attachment, I gather.
It depends on how strongly you want to read the case. I think if I were God of the world, I would say you have to have a proper filing, but where you draw that line, I don't know, and it's really not important in this case. For this case, notice was given, notice was received, it was responded to. Larson, what was sent...
Now, there have been cases where there was actual notice under 403A without actual personal service. And
403A is different.
Why in, as a matter of common sense or logic, would we require, why would we allow for actual notice to be sufficient under all of the other provisions, all the other paragraphs, but not under A, if the formality has not been met?
I can answer that question, Your Honor. That's the way the committee wrote the rule.
But, counsel, I guess...
Well, I guess I'm asking you, why should we think that's the way the committee wrote the rule if neither of us is aware of any case where personal service is treated more strictly than the service requirements under any of the other paragraphs?
Because that's what the words of the rule say, Your Honor. And hey, none of the cases I read has this ever been argued before. But to say that personal service is required is to say there's a word in there that is not in there. In Larson, the court said, when actual notice has been received, rules should be liberally construed. Additionally,
but counsel, I mean, my problems with the, and it does say that in Larson, and you talked about O'Sell, but both of those are cases from the 1990s, and, you know, we have these recent cases like the Yeager case where the Supreme Court, you know, said, no, we're going to do strict compliance, and regardless of whether the intended recipient has received actual notice, doesn't that really call into question the holdings of those cases?
Because it's a protection to the responding party. You have to get notice. You have to be able to respond, or we don't have justice. Here it's being used as a sword. To quote Meeker County's attorney at the hearing, in a normal case, I'm not going to oppose a motion to join parties that I myself have said need to be part of the action. But that's a normal case where we don't have time, a time period to perfect. Here it was used as a sword to deprive people of trying to keep rifle rounds from going through their house. That is not the meaning of Rule 4 whatsoever. Everything that Rule 4 was built for was complied with and happened in this case. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Thank you, and thank you for the argument of both counsel and for both your written submissions and your oral arguments today. The matter is submitted. We will issue our opinion within the statutory period. Our next argument will be heard from this.